The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
From issues across foreign and domestic policy, the US voter is weighing up a decision for the election in November. As Kamala Harris's campaign gathers momentum, Trump's approach continues to divide even those within his own party. For example, the former Republican Lieutenant Governor for Georgia, Jeff Duncan, has himself vowed to vote for Kamala Harris later this year.
I want to get my party back and be able to build a GOP 2.0. And the only way to do that is to let the Democrats win this election. But also, I think it's important to reinforce the fact to Republicans around the country that just because you vote for Kamala Harris in 2024 doesn't mean you're a Democrat. It just means you're a patriot. You're doing your duty as an American to step up to the plate and reclaim this country's future.
Well, I'm joined in studio by Mark Rozell, author and dean of the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. He's with me in studio. Good morning, Mark, and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, it's a very interesting election this year because it was game, set and match, we thought, to Donald Trump based on Biden's performance in the debate with Trump and also concerns about his age and his ability to do another, not another 6 months, but rather 4 years.
Yeah, exactly right. And Biden was just not doing well, and the debate was disastrous. And so a lot of the party leaders really surrounded him and put a lot of pressure on him to make the decision that he ultimately did make, to step out of the race and let someone else step forward, because the polling data were devastating. They showed that Biden simply had a very narrow path to the presidency based on the various competitive states in the Electoral College that were tilting significantly to Donald Trump. So most feel that he did the right thing under that circumstance.
Now, it's part of Trump's shtick at the moment to project Biden as someone who's been usurped, deposed.
Right. Well, that's not accurate because political parties are private entities in the United States. They can nominate whoever they want to. And although most of us expected, once the president decided to step down, that there would be multiple candidates stepping forward, there would be a competition for the nomination that would go all the way to the Democratic Party convention. But what ultimately happened is the president gave that endorsement to Kamala Harris, and amazingly, the party activists and the party leaders just all came together. They united behind the president.
They looked at the calendar, though. How much time do we have? Do we want blood on the floor in the convention?
Well, that's exactly right. And that was the best thing for the Democrats, that they united. And I think under other circumstances, that would not have happened. But the fact that Donald Trump is the Republican nominee and Democrats see this as an existential threat to American democracy, our rule of law, the continuity of our democratic institutions, that they had to come together for the purpose of beating Donald Trump.
Now, how derailed has the Trump campaign been by the sudden emergence of Kamala Harris and then Tim Walz added as her vice presidential nominee?
I don't want to overstate it. The polling data show that this is still a very close race and Donald Trump has a path to win the presidency. It might not be quite 50-50. It leans a little bit Harris right now, but she's had something like a honeymoon for the past 3 weeks. She became the new flavor. And Tim Walz, of course, added to that narrative. And she's been before very large fawning audiences. She has not been before a press conference or any vehicle of critical analysis where she's been challenged. But that's going to happen in the next 82 days. The Republicans are going to really come after her. And most of the states in the Electoral College that were leaning red or Republican, they're still there. So this election is still about approximately six states in the Electoral College, which is exactly what it was when Biden was the presumed nominee of the Democratic Party.
The Trump platform, I mean, he promised the earth in his first term, and the earth really didn't move.
That should be a problem for him, but he has a certain kind of following that's very intense, very loyal. Now, one of the things that he did in the 2016 campaign that surprised people was win narrow margins in a number of Midwest, upper Midwest industrial states that typically had gone Democratic. And his appeal to white working class voters because of the decline of the manufacturing sector was largely credited for those wins in states that he wasn't supposed to win that delivered the presidency to him. But think of this. He was promising to bring back declining sectors of the American economy. And he wasn't able to do that while he was president. He wasn't able to bring back the steel industry and the coal industry and, you know, the manufacturing sector, the larger geopolitical circumstances and international economic factors were just too great.
But he's going to blame Biden, isn't he, for all of that?
Well, that's exactly right. And politically, that's the smart thing to do, right? Because we've had the worst inflation in four decades during the Biden presidency. It has hit the middle and lower middle class very hard. If you're in the top 10, 20% of income in America, you're doing great right now. The stock market is generally doing well. You're not feeling the effects of petrol prices being higher and grocery prices higher. But for most of America, people feel that very deeply. And I think every time somebody passes a petrol station and sees the big sign with the price on it, mm-hmm. that's like a campaign ad against the Democrats. So that's a difficulty for Kamala Harris, right? Because she is, of course, the vice president of the incumbent administration that the American public is blaming for the hyperinflation and the high interest rates as well.
Now, the Trump we saw in the interview on X with Elon Musk was a very mentally scattered Trump, disjointed and not the supremely confident creature we see in front of the huge crowds, almost as if he missed that kind of feedback from the crowd. But here he is consorting with the richest man in America, who is the author of the creation of EV, I suppose the EV revolution in the United States with the arrival of the Tesla. And this was a movement that Trump just described as fake and fraud.
That's right.
So and now go figure.
Well, go figure, right. And now he's going before public audiences in his speeches and saying, you know what, electric vehicles are okay. Go out and buy them, especially Tesla. So there you go. So Elon Musk, he owns the platform X. He's using it as a vehicle to promote right-wing views. He's endorsed Donald Trump. This was not real journalism, this interview. It was an opportunity that Elon Musk gave to the person he endorsed for the presidency to spout whatever views he wanted. And Musk threw a bunch of what we call softball questions at him so that Trump can make his case before his following, who tend to like the Platform X now.
The paths to the presidency, you mentioned that Joe Biden's path was narrowing all the time. What has happened to Kamala Harris's path? How much broader than Joe Biden's is it now, given all those swing states which are so important?
So the polling data show substantially more for Kamala Harris because she has shifted the polls by at least a few or even several percentage points in each of the critical states in the Electoral College. So we all say that right now there are six critical states that are going to decide this election. I think everybody understands we have a state-by-state winner-takes-all Electoral College system, not a national popular vote for the presidency. So please don't be following the national political preference polls. They don't mean anything.
We have to remember that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. Joe Biden won it handsomely, too.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Kamala Harris needs to win those critical states in the Electoral College. And I would say she needs to have at least a 3 to 4 percentage point advantage in the national popular opinion polls in order to win the presidency. Donald Trump has a statistical advantage in the Electoral College that he doesn't have to win a majority vote. And he didn't, of course, in 2016, in order to win the presidency. He just needs to win by some narrow margins in those critical states in the Electoral College. And the Democrat will run up huge popular majorities in big states like California, but that doesn't matter. It's the distribution of votes that matters.
In looking at America today with the stacking of the Supreme Court by Donald Trump, which is available to any president who's lucky enough to have a retirement or a death in the Supreme Court during their tenure, but it suggests that the fundamental building blocks of the American democracy are not appropriate to the modern age.
Right. So the Supreme Court right now is perceived by much of the American public as just another political institution. Now, I've been a political scientist for four decades, and, you know, we always were taught and always believed that the courts were different. They were distinct. They're above politics, right? The justices have lifetime tenure. They don't have to worry about temporary political passions. But with some of the decisions that this Supreme Court has made in the past several years, Americans perceive it as just a politically bought and paid for entity. Whether accurate or not, that's the perception.
It would appear to be so, though.
Well, Donald Trump got three, and that's extraordinary in 1 4-year term for that to have happened.
And this is a lifetime job and no sanction. There doesn't seem to be only that the joint houses of Congress can get rid of a judge who misbehaves.
Right.
So all the scandals about Clarence Thomas at the moment and being on the take from billionaire buddies.
Yes.
No one's going to do anything about that.
Right. And Joe Biden has presented a platform of reforms of the court system in the United States, but as much as I like the ideas that he's presenting, limiting tenure to 18 years, having ethics reforms and limitations, so examples like you just pointed out can't happen again without sanction, but it would require a constitutional amendment, which would be really hard to do.
Yeah. Now, the battle of the vice presidents. Mm-hmm. J.D. Vance, when he was first appointed by Trump, nominated by Trump, hillbilly elegy, a great rags-to-riches story, a great American success story. And then he opened his mouth and he put his foot in it. Frequently.
Yes.
And it turned out that he'd also done it in the past, but got no publicity for such errors. How do you compare him, and what about Walz, and was he bearing arms in war or was he not?
Right. So the J.D. Vance pick, I think, was a big mistake. Let's go back to when that happened. There had been just recently the assassination attempt against Mr. Trump. Joe Biden was still the presumptive nominee. Trump was riding high in the polls against Biden. And former President Trump thought, let's pick somebody young who can be a legacy of the Trump movement and carry it on beyond my time. I think that's exactly what he was thinking. And J.D. Vance seemed to fit that mold. That's the kind of pick you make if you really think you're going to win and that there's no chance of losing the election. Mm. And believe me, at that point, after the assassination attempt and at the Republican convention, when Vance was announced, the overriding sentiment in the United States was that this is just about over at this point. Yeah. I even heard many prominent Democrats privately saying, you know what, if we can just hold one house of Congress so we can block Trump's agenda for the next 4 years. That's what the election is all about now. They were giving up any hope of winning. So the whole thing got transformed when Biden stepped down and Kamala Harris ultimately became the nominee. But now the Vance pick is not looking very good for the Republicans. Tim Walz looks like a great choice right now. But I want to caution here a little bit. And I'll give credit to Donald Trump for having said something absolutely correct when he was asked about this. The vice presidential nominee doesn't really move the needle very much in American presidential elections. The data show that going back generations. Mm-hmm.
But you know this notion of the heartbeat away from the presidency.
Well,
and when you had Joe Biden and Donald Trump, you're looking at guys who are, you know, just coming up to 80 or beyond 80.
Yep.
So that has more resonance maybe than it might have had if you've got a 45-year-old candidate or a 55-year-old candidate.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it should be more important than people place on it, the vice presidential choice, that is. So again, historically, people vote for the presidential candidate. They don't really think very much of the vice presidential nominee. But with a 78-year-old as the nominee of the Republican Party, he'll be into his 80s if he's elected again. You're right. Voters may be thinking just a little bit more carefully now about the vice presidential choice.
Do we want President Vance in the event of any cognitive or physical decline on the part of Donald Trump?
He's had 18 months in the Senate. He's 39 years old. He hasn't really been tested in politics. He hasn't worked his way up through the system in any sense. It's hard to imagine him as the leader of the country right now.
And then President Walz, possible?
Right.
Can people see that?
I think so. I mean, he's had a good career in politics, in a sense, 6 terms in the House of Representatives, governor of a pretty big state, right? So he's had legislative experience. He's had executive experience and a rather remarkable background that is very relatable to Americans, serving in the military reserves, being a public school teacher for 20 years, being an American football coach, right, in high school.
He's ticking a lot of boxes.
He's ticking all the boxes, and it really works.
Now, two issues that are going to maybe not front and central all the way through these campaigns, because you never know which way they're going to go. But at the moment, abortion and the mantra from the Harris campaign, you know, stay out of our daughters' bedrooms or bodies or whatever. It's quite powerful for women. How does that resonate with the male voter?
Well, it depends which male voter, right? So the male vote leans Republican in the United States overall, but this is election that's about the margins, since it's going to be a very close race. And you're looking at the swing voters, both men and women, who they might not have a strong preference for one political party or the other. They are persuadable. They might be thinking about the prices of groceries and petrol and the like and interest rates. But on the other hand, wow, that abortion decision, and what does it mean to my daughter?
Yeah.
A lot of men are thinking about that, believe me, not just women. And that was a hugely unpopular decision. I mean, even in so-called red or Republican-leaning states, public opinion polls have shown that people are not happy with that Supreme Court decision, and they think it was better under Roe versus Wade, when abortion rights were protected nationally by the courts.
The other issue, of course, is Gaza.
Yes.
And the contradiction, Joe Biden, and the search for some sort of a peace process, a truce, and the liberation of the hostages, and then a $20 billion agreement for arms for Israel. You know, the two don't sit necessarily that well.
This is one of those what we call lose-lose issues. There's just not a political win here one way or the other. So President Biden, after October 7, did the right thing in expressing his strong support, unwavering support for Israel, but he had no idea what Netanyahu was going to do. And there's a lot of tension now between the White House and Mr. Netanyahu over how Israel has prosecuted this war, which has had serious political reverberations back in the United States. Now, this is a potential problem for Kamala Harris, because the most intense criticism in U.S. domestic politics is coming from the progressive left that is very sympathetic to the plight of the Palestinians. And you've seen in the news, you know, what's been happening at U.S. colleges and universities, you know, hotbeds of American liberalism. And then there have been protests even at Kamala Harris's own political rallies. So the Democrats have to find a message here some way. And the complication for Kamala Harris is she's vice president to an incumbent president right now. She can't look disloyal, but yet somehow she has to separate herself from the unpopular actions of this administration.
When you look at Netanyahu, though, he's eyeing a Trump presidency. I mean, Trump was the man who moved the embassy to Jerusalem against a lot of advice to the contrary. I mean, he's definitely pro-Israel in a more emphatic way than Joe Biden is, even though historically Joe Biden has been very favorable to Israel.
That's right.
But for Netanyahu, and trying to lure him to some sort of peace conference, when he knows that that would be a big political win for Biden, therefore making a Harris presidency more likely.
Yes.
So why would he bother trying to sort this out?
He's not going to. That's just he's looking out after his own interest and his own protection, both politically and perhaps even legally, given various circumstances that we all know about. And his tight relationship with Mr. Trump, I think, is driving a lot of what he's doing. But you may have seen, right, Kamala Harris gives a public presentation, a fawning audience, but then there are protesters, and she finally stops at one point, you know, and she makes clear, I don't want to disrespect your right of protest, but do you really want Donald Trump to win? She just put it right to them. You know, if you want Donald Trump to win, why don't you just come right out and say it? But right now I'm talking. And it was very effective, because for the protesters, the politically progressive-minded people who are very angry at this administration over its policy on Israel and Gaza, do they really think it's going to be better with a President Donald Trump? Think of the big picture. That was the message she was conveying.
Very effective.
It was extremely effective.
Confronting them with, you know, here's your choice. Are you going to vote for RFK Jr.? With the worm in his brain?
Exactly.
Anyway, it's fascinating talking with you. Thank you very much for sharing your wisdom. Mark J. Rozelle, along with Clyde Wilcox, is the author of, how would you describe it, a small volume called Federalism, A Very Short Introduction.
Yeah, it's part of the Oxford University Press Very Short Introduction series, which is quite popular.
Well, Mark is Dean of the Shar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Thank you very much for joining us in studio.
Thank you.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.